Mark Hertzgaard thinks that political campaigns have become public relations campaigns. Image counts more than a candidate's stand on the issues. Hertzgaard is an investigative journalist who has spent several years examining how political advisors manipulate the press to get the desired image across. His new book, On Bended Knee, is a study of the press and the Reagan presidency. His previous book, Nuclear Inc., investigated the men and money behind nuclear energy. In his new book, On Bended Knee, Hertzgaard maintains that the rules of presidential image-making were rewritten by Reagan's former White House Chief of Staff, Michael Deaver, and former Director of Communications, David Gergen. Hertzgaard writes, quote, "They introduced a new model for packaging the nation's top politician and using the press to sell him to the American public. Their objective was not simply to tame the press, but to transform it into an unwitting mouthpiece of the government," unquote. Mark Hertzgaard told me that he thinks this was done on the basis of a sophisticated analysis of the American news media, how it works, which buttons to push when, exploiting the press's weaknesses.
Well, I think in particular the distinguishing characteristic of the Reagan propaganda apparatus was that they realized that for television in particular, stories about the White House and about the president are commodities, and very profitable commodities at that. And this was central to their understanding that the media would take what they give them. Les Janka, who I interviewed for the book, was a deputy press secretary in the Reagan White House. And he said that the strategy that we used was essentially manipulation by inundation. And he drew a distinction between that and the strategy that the Nixon White House had used, which Nixon, he said, essentially tried to restrict access, keep information from reporters, whereas the Reagan people realized that, as he put it, the press will take what we feed them. If we come in there and give them a pre-masticated, well-packaged story every day in the format that they want, that they'll take it, and sooner or later they'll stop bringing their own stories and being an investigative reporter of any sort. I went to Mike Deaver and asked him about that, and he actually gave one of the best quotes, I think, in the book, at least to me, one of the most amusing. He said, you know, I think that's right. In fact, the only day I really worried about was Fridays, because it's a slow news day here in Washington, and if I didn't give them, that is reporters, if I didn't give them a story, they'd go out and find something. Well, tell that to Thomas Jefferson. That's not the kind of press that we're supposed to have in this country. The press is supposed to be aggressive and independent and a check and balance on the White House. And I think, unfortunately, during the Reagan years, it was too often a rubber stamp.
Well, now, you say that during the Reagan years, the public image makers wanted to control the message, to control the message going out to the press, and that there was even something that they called, or you called, I'm not sure which, the line of the day. Is that their word or your word?
That's their word, astonishingly enough. That's the kind of word that you would expect to find in totalitarian societies, and yet every morning, the White House, at the White House morning briefing, Larry Speaks, or whoever was the press secretary, would come out, and they had met at 8:15 that morning in a meeting called the Line of the Day meeting, and Larry would give the assembled White House reporters the line of the day.
What would a typical line of the day be? Do you remember what any of them were?
Well, none of them would tell me exactly what they were, but you could generally get a sense from looking at the coverage. The line of the day generally got through more or less intact. I remember during Grenada, one of the lines of the days was the second day of the invasion, that Bud McFarlane was quoted, the National Security Advisor, was quoted as saying, "We got there just in time," speaking of U.S. troops on the way to Grenada. And the president, of course, then used that in his speech later that day. And that was the line of the day, that we, the United States, got to Grenada just in time to hold off a Cuban Soviet base there. Of course, it turned out upon later examination of the facts that there was little danger of the Cubans taking over in Grenada, but by that time the press had already bought the story and the American public was convinced of the rightness of the cause.
You also say that President Reagan's media advisors have limited the president's access to the press. Why?
Well, I think Sam Donaldson told me that the reason that Deaver doesn't put President Reagan out there answering questions is because he's ignorant of current events. And I think that's true. They realize that Ronald Reagan, when you take away his teleprompter, is basically an ignorant, confused man. And he will repeatedly put his foot in his mouth and say things like he did the other night at the Republican convention, facts are stupid things. Well, that's the kind of thing that repeatedly done, it gets the president in a lot of trouble. So they kept the president away from the press and just gave the press these carefully choreographed photo opportunities.
How did they keep the president away from the press?
Well, it just didn't let them have access. You know, the reporters in the White House are actually kept on a pretty tight leash. They see the president maybe once a week, and when they do see him, he's getting ready to get into a helicopter. They have to shout their questions, and the most that they get is one question to which Reagan can give a well-prepared one-liner. It's one of the things that he's best at, instead of making the president available under open conditions for in-depth interviews or press conferences.
Now, you've said that Michael Deaver was really a master of staging flattering photo sessions for the president. How would he do that?
Well, Deaver had a very good eye for color, for contrast, and for the kind of image that would be conveyed. He would, when President Reagan went overseas on trips, Deaver would go over sometimes as much as a month in advance and plan out exactly what kind of photos he wanted television networks to cover. So that, for example, when the president went to Korea in late 83, shortly after the Grenada invasion, Deaver had choreographed this in advance and had Reagan step up to the demilitarized zone and give a picture where he was in a flak jacket with field glasses on, staring across the line to the communists on the other side. And, of course, it was a very flattering picture of the president. I remember Andrea Mitchell, the NBC White House correspondent, told me later that she was covering that once the president was there, and she saw that he had missed his toe mark when they were doing the story, and she saw one of his aides give him the high sign and move him over into the sunshine. So Deaver had actually planned out exactly where the sun would be shining on such a day so that it would have the perfect image to convey this impression of a powerful, strong, courageous leader.
Was this emphasis on image made because the image makers thought that that was a good way to communicate, or is it because of a bias that they see in the press that the image predominates over the word?
Well, I think it's both. They knew that Reagan comes across a lot better in how he looks than in how he speaks. And then also, of course, they recognize that, for television, what they care about is pretty pictures. And, it got to the point where one of the senior producers on the CBS Evening News told me that Michael Deaver should have been listed as the executive producer on all of our political stories in 1981. That's how pervasive the White House control was over what Americans saw on television.
My guest is journalist Mark Hertzgard, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. And according to Hertzgard, President Reagan's advisors rewrote the rules of presidential image making, and the American press let itself be manipulated. Let's talk about how some of these media techniques were applied during different parts of the Reagan presidency. Let's look at Iran-Contra, which was the greatest problem that the president was faced with in terms of stories breaking about his presidency. How were some of the things you were discussing put into play when the Iran-Contra story broke?
Well, I think the Iran-Contra story, you're right, was the instance of the most critical coverage of the president. I would say that this is something most Americans don't recognize, but in fact, the Iran-Contra story was around 18 months before it ever broke into the headlines. The New York Times, in particular, had the Ali North story on its front page in August of 1985. They did not name North, but they had all the essentials of the story, that the war on Nicaragua was being run out of the White House. But the story wasn't followed up. And this gets to another part of the book, not just how the White House manipulates, but how the press censors itself. I asked reporters in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times why that story wasn't followed up. And they explained that basically it was very clear that that was not what New York headquarters wanted. And I think that was related to the fact that reporters around the Times knew that the executive editor of the Times, Abe Rosenthal, tended to look very critically at stories that were critical of the Nicaraguan Contras. In 1983, so that would be, 2 years before that, Mr. Rosenthal had removed a reporter of his, Ray Bonner, from the El Salvador beat after Bonner's reporting had provoked a right-wing backlash here within the Reagan administration and by its right-wing allies. So that's the first thing that I would say about Iran-Contra, which is that the press came to the story late, even though it was right in front of it. And then the second thing is that the press didn't really get its teeth into that story until the administration gave it to it, until Ed Meese came out in the famous White House press conference and said, we've discovered that arms that went to Iran were used to buy weapons for the Contras. Only then, only when a government official had announced that the sky is blue, did reporters finally really get onto the story. That, I think, was, to get back to your question about techniques, that was a perfect example of the kind of damage control operation that Reagan's handlers had been perfecting from the first day that he was in office. If you are able to define what the story is in the way that Ed Meese did that day, you can limit the damage. And what in particular the White House did throughout the Iran-Contra affair was to try and narrow the focus of inquiry so that the issue became, did President Reagan know specifically about the diversion of funds to the Contras? When in fact, the issue should have been, did President Reagan, what was President Reagan's involvement, and wasn't he responsible for this wholesale, unconstitutional, secret government that was operating within the White House?
Narrowing down a story, defining how the story will be interpreted, that's spin, right? Putting your spin on a story.
Yes, that's certainly one example of spin. And, of course, the other techniques that they used were to keep the press away from Reagan, to put him on television. Now, not all these techniques worked, I want to stress. You know, Reagan's first few speeches where he said, we didn't trade arms for hostages, the American people saw through that. And in fact, it was going downhill there for a while in November. And quite a number of Americans, there was as much as half of the American public thought that Reagan was lying and that perhaps he should resign. And then Meese's press conference really turned it around, and it gave the White House some control over the future development of the story.
Let's look at the invasion of Grenada. There was a press ban that was in effect, and you suggest that part of the reason for that, you say you were told this by David Gergen, that part of the reason was you can't carry on a war anymore if it's shown on television, that they learned this from Vietnam, that people don't want to see Americans getting wounded. They don't want to see it on their television, so you just can't show it.
Yes, that was actually Deaver who said that.
And oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sure they both believe it. He said that we used to be able to do that during World War II when, with Ernie Pyle, and you go to the movie theaters on Saturdays and you see a newsreel, but every night in your living room we can't do that. So I asked him, I said, well, weren't you worried about a backlash from the press? And he said, no, I really wasn't, because the story was such a positive story that it didn't really matter. Well, again, I think he turned out to be right, but that was only because the press completely bought into all of the really deceptive claims that the Reagan administration made about the invasion, that the students were in danger. In fact, they were more endangered by the U.S. invading troops, that the Soviets and the Cubans were ready to turn Grenada into an outpost. In fact, they weren't, and so forth and so on. And yet the networks really played Grenada as the president's finest hour. And again, there's another instance of self-censorship. ABC News had the story of the Grenada invasion the night before, and they declined to broadcast it because they got a wave off from the Pentagon. An ABC crew in Barbados actually had footage of U.S. troops on their way to Grenada, and they had confirmation from the embassy there. They sent the story and the pictures up to ABC headquarters in New York, and with 1 minute to go, the ABC Pentagon correspondent, John McQuethy, called back to the office and said that he had been waved off and told that the story wasn't true. And unfortunately, the executive producer of the broadcast believed the Pentagon rather than the eyewitness accounts of his own reporters. And I think that gets to really one of the major problems that I tried to demonstrate in the book, which is that when in doubt, the press in this country tends to believe the government.
But you make it sound like it's an easy call, which I think it really isn't. It's a very difficult ethical call, isn't it? When you've called the Pentagon, they deny a story, or they tell you to sit on a story for reasons of national security. That is not an easy call to make.
Well, they did not. It wasn't for reasons of national security. That is a tougher call to make. I agree with you. When someone says that for national security reasons, we can't, you shouldn't do this. That isn't what happened in the case of ABC. The information was never really accepted. It was a case where the Pentagon basically told a lie that was close enough to the truth to be believed, and the executive producer in New York bought that rather than what his own reporters had seen.
Well, there's a lot left to talk about. I want to talk with you about the current campaign and how you think these public relations techniques are being applied, if at all. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Mark Hertzgard, and we're discussing his new book on Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. And in this book, he outlines his view that the press played into the hands of the Reagan administration image makers. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Investigative journalist Mark Hertzgard is my guest, author of On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. One of the ideas that you present in your book is that the Reagan administration had a set of image makers who created new ways of packaging the president for the press. And I think that you suggest that George Bush is actually carrying that on in his campaign now. I'd like to look at the current campaign and compare it to the Reagan-Mondale campaign. What similarities do you see in this campaign to that one?
I think there's a great number of similarities. I think that if George Bush learned one thing from Ronald Reagan, it was how to run a political campaign in such a way that you get good press coverage. One of the first things you do is hire Jim Baker. Baker is Bush's longtime friend and the chairman of his campaign. He also was the man who was the White House chief of staff during President Reagan's first term. And I think that Bush is essentially following the same model that Reagan did in 84, which is that you restrict reporters' access to the candidate and you provide very gimmicky, happy talk, photo opportunity type campaign appearances. Unfortunately, the press seems to be repeating its performance in 1984 as well and declining to smoke out the candidates and force them to answer tough questions. As it is, Mr. Bush and to a lesser extent Dukakis, who to his credit has continued to accept reporters' questions and made himself available. But Mr. Bush in particular, I think, is therefore managing to define the conditions under which he will be covered. And I think that's dangerous because it leaves the it lets him decide what kind of picture is going to be presented to the public. And as a result, he's not answering questions, for example, about the Iran-Contra affair.
Well, I want to ask you something. You suggest that the press is getting snookered by White House advisors and political campaigners, that they're accepting basically PR-type things that are put before them. But I have the September 5th issue of Time magazine in front of me, and this is over the whole brouhaha about whether schoolchildren should or should not be required to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning. So this is the opening of the Time magazine article about that. Prison furloughs, school prayer, and the Indiana National Guard are not matters that often cross a president's desk. But to campaign consultants, they are, quote, hot buttons that help voters define a candidate's character and values. So last week, while the national debt was topping $2.5 trillion, while a growing army of beggars wandered urban streets and America's overburdened school systems prepared for the return of classes, the electorate was treated to the spectacle of George Bush forcing Michael Dukakis to debate whether elementary school children should be compelled to recite a loyalty oath before they rattle off their ABCs. So there you are in Time magazine, you know, the big campaign story saying, well, this is all image-making stuff. This has absolutely nothing to do with what either of them would do if elected into office, but this is what they're talking about this week.
Well, I applaud that. I'm glad to see that Time does that. I wish they would have done more of it over the last 8 years, I must say. You know, I'm speaking a little bit in broad strokes here because there's always some good coverage in the press. The press is not a monolith, and there are good reporters within it, and some news organizations shine at sometimes and others at others. Unfortunately, so much of campaigning these days is television, and even a major national organ like Time doesn't have the sway that it used to. And on television, you know, when Time writes about how the voters are being talked to about Pledge of Allegiance, that's happening over television. Television is really the main culprit here, and sad to say, there's much less room for decent coverage on television.
Do you think that television is more... the television is more readily falls prey to image manipulators than the press because they feel they're so dependent on good pictures?
Yes, I think they do. And also, what is television? Television is image, you know, so it only makes sense that they'd be more susceptible to that. You know, the rule about television is that what matters is the appearance, not the reality. And as a result, I think that they allow themselves too often to be taken over by the tyranny of the visual. There are ways to cover a campaign without doing that. You don't have to show the pictures of George Bush running through Boston Harbor or what have you. If the campaign doesn't give you what you want, you can get pictures elsewhere. But unfortunately, our television journalists tend not to think that way.
Well, if the campaign isn't making the candidate available, or if the White House isn't making the president available, what alternatives do you think the press has to get access to the decision makers?
Well, I think that they can do tough investigative reporting. They can do reporting. They can lead their broadcast, for example, by saying that Vice President Bush today again declined to make himself available for reporters' questions, preferring instead a photo opportunity appearance at such and such plant. Now, you know, I said before that the press has declined to smoke out Mr. Bush this fall, in the same way that they did Reagan in 84. And I asked Bill Plant, the CBS White House correspondent, why the press had not led newspapers once or twice with stories about the president's inaccessibility or led the evening broadcast. And he gave a revealing answer. He said that, well, we could do that, but were we to do that in order to smoke him out, that would be to depart substantially from the canons of how we present the news. Well, he's right about that, but I think that those canons are very wrong, because it allows the candidates essentially to decide how they will be covered.
Every day you pick up the papers or tune on TV, there's a new poll that is comparing how Bush and Dukakis are faring. What do you think about this emphasis on polls? Do you think it's happening at the expense of focusing on issues?
Of course. I think the emphasis on polls is idiotic. It's driven by ratings. By ratings, in a sense that the way that you get people to watch is that you cover it like a sports contest. Who's ahead? Who's behind? You know, the coverage in the, particularly in the papers, but also on television, of these campaigns has far more to do with tactics and how the candidate is trying to position himself rather than the issues. Let's take a look at what Michael Dukakis says about the environment. George Bush goes to criticize him. Let's look at Dukakis's record. How does Mr. Dukakis plan to pay for the programs that he proposes? Where does Mr. Dukakis get his money? Where does Mr. Bush get his money? What does Mr. Bush think about what's his record on Iran-Contra, the 12 meetings or what have you? You know, there are issues after issues to be discussing, but unfortunately the press has bought into the same notion that is promulgated by the image makers, which is that the public doesn't care about issues. I think that's nonsense. I think that's cynical and patronizing of a great people. Our people do care about issues if you present them with them.
In your book, you suggest that President Reagan's media advisors rewrote the rules of presidential image making. Do you think that those rules have been permanently rewritten?
One hopes not. I prefer to be optimistic about these things. I think that the press, if it does return to first principles and remembers that that the American Revolution championed, among other things, the idea of a free and independent press, that they certainly can fight back against these sorts of restrictions.
Have you ever worked in the daily press yourself?
No.
Do a lot of daily journalists get annoyed with you for critiquing press performance when you haven't worked as a daily press member yourself?
I don't know, not that I'm aware of. I certainly consider myself part of the press. I do investigative reporting and have worked for magazines mainly. My father was an anchorman, so I've sort of seen it
really?
from that side. And it's not really my cup of tea. I prefer to be a little bit more thoughtful and dig deeper. And that's not, unfortunately, investigative journalism is not something that is very highly valued at the daily newspapers these days. And I dare say after writing this book, I wouldn't get any job offers anyway.
Well, let me ask you this. You do investigative reporting. You criticize the press for not doing enough of it. When you do an investigative piece, do you feel like anybody actually pays attention to it?
I think that that's one of the problems with journalism and with politics in general. You can never know what effect you have. You know, a businessman at the end of the year can look at the bottom line and he either did well or he did poorly. Journalism doesn't work that way. You have to, in a sense, follow your own gut, follow your own instincts and your morality. And I think, frankly, that journalists worry a little bit too much about that. One of the reasons that, at least journalists told me, one of the reasons that they stopped doing Reagan gaffe stories in 1983 was because they were getting a lot of pressure, both from their superiors and from the public. You can't worry about that. That's not the job of the press, you know, to say that that the public doesn't like this. It's like a brain surgeon saying that, well, I won't do this because the patient doesn't want it. The job of the brain surgeon is to tell the patient what is needed in the same way that the job of the journalist is to elucidate issues for the public.
As you continue to watch the presidential campaign, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, I, as you know, I pay special attention to how the what the public perception is, that is to say, how the press is covering them, what sort of messages get conveyed through the press to the public. The press has such an important role in our democracy. It is the voice through which the average citizen finds out what his or her government is doing. So I pay very close attention to that and try and see how good a job the press does of keeping these candidates honest and informing the public about what they're really up to.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. My guest is Mark Hertzgaard. His new book is titled On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.